When people start thinking about savory cocktails, the one that everyone's familiar with is like a Bloody Mary. You know, when people say savory cocktails and they frown, then you're like, you probably drink gallons of that every Sunday.
So
taking that aspect, I think a really easy progression would be to, yeah, use tomato, but how do we do it in a modern setting? How do we make this ingredient last a little bit longer? Yeah, we heat treat it, we can clarify it. So all these tools just kind of like gives a bit more consistency and saves a bit of waste.
This is To Be Delicious, a Lekker mini-series looking at food heritage through the lens of umami and the ingredient of MSG. I'm Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing, a writer and academic who is particularly interested in looking at ingredients as a way to understand the world we live in. Across 5 episodes, we speak to chefs, academics, cooks, and bartenders to explore some of my research into how MSG is part of our culinary heritage. In this episode, we think about the future of MSG. Food and drink always evolve. Ingredients take on new meanings as contexts change. And so we decided to look at what MSG is doing in the world of drinks. Because I think MSG should be seen as an ingredient of fun and creativity. And there is a lot of fun to be had in throwing things together and shaking it about. MSG shaken and stirred. Sian Wong, bartender and Schweppes brand ambassador, shows us how to make an MSG cocktail she created for an event and talks about growing up in a Chinese family in the hospitality industry in the UK. We also speak with Ryan Chetty Wardner, also known as Mr. Lion, a world-renowned bartender who has bars in London, Washington DC and Amsterdam, and who I also happen to work with as I work for Mr. Lion's Studio, the creative agency arm of the group. This episode was sparked by a conversation Ryan and I had. I was telling him about the research I was doing, and he, in classic Ryan form, articulated my thoughts, my queries, and points that could be good to interrogate in under 10 minutes, and offered some really interesting ways of framing MSG, umami, and how to think about the research. So I asked if we could get all of that again, formally, on record.
So my name is Ryan Chetty Wardner. I've ended up using the kind of Mr. Lion moniker, which has been, I suppose, our way of linking lots of different types of projects together, where at the heart of it, it's what I see as the role of being a bartender. You're hosting people, you're creating delicious things, you're telling stories, you're making connections, and you're finding ways to help gatherings feel more meaningful for people. And as a result of, I suppose, taking quite a wide view of what a bartender can be, it's covered, obviously, our venues where we get to do more traditional bartending, although I don't think we do it in a very traditional way, but also books, TV stuff, events, collaborations, working with lots of different industries, trying to find ways of kind of pushing where does that boundary lie, where can we continue to work in the world of food and drink, and you know, what can we get to explore by being a bartender in the modern world?
And you talk about making drinks accessible and connecting. There's a real culture element to what you do as well, isn't there?
Hugely. It kind of exists to be something that can exist in your everyday sense as well as it can be something that feels special to people. But I think that idea of doing good and trying to do things differently was kind of very central to really what underpinned everything that we wanted to do. So bring people together, gather lots of brilliant minds who can also start to go, well, where do we get to explore where good things exist?
I thought it might be good to take a little pause and explain a bit more about why we decided to look at the world of drinks. I have written about food for a very long time, and in the last few years have begun to write more and more about drinks. This is because we often see drinks, and particularly alcohol, as these liquids in a bottle or your glass, as separate from land, people, and communities. But so much of the drink we drink today comes from cultural traditions, are or were part of rituals, ceremonies, and our everyday life moments. They are products of the land and a part of farming cycles, whether purposefully or as a way to utilise excess produce. alcohol is fermentation. I've written in the past about the connection between culture, identity and drink with Tuak, the Iban fermented drink made from rice. But because drinks do sit in this slightly separate space from food, rightly or wrongly, especially cocktails, which seem to have a global aspect to them that at first glance may not seem anchored in time and place, drinks have been able to be seen in a scientific and highly creative way. It seems like an interesting starting point to interrogate around the idea of umami, MSG, and ideas of creativity. And with the people who absolutely believe in drinks having a relevance to time, space, culture, community, and people. And another interesting point is that often people think cocktails need to be sweet, but what does sweetness actually mean in drinks?
Bartending and cocktails in a very loose sense, or I suppose to me in a more meaningful connection to what they're meant to be about. But it was really about putting people and the magic of the world at the centre of the business. And it's been really exciting to then see, okay, where can we start to kind of bridge these things, bring it to life, but also how can we learn and help connect and grow and change the dynamic of what food and drink hopefully looks like.
You use this word magic, which I really like. And I feel like with this podcast talking about MSG and umami, like that is magic in a way. Like it's kind of this weird little thing that happens and comes and creates. Thinking about that idea of magic, but thinking about like where did it come from and what was your upbringing in terms of flavors and foods and drinks and how did that feature into why you're in this world of flavor, I guess.
I feel very fortunate in terms of what we were exposed to. And that's as much about, I suppose, our encouragement to be both curious and respectful of things. You know, it was funny growing up with kind of two Sri Lankan parents. We didn't have much Sri Lankan cuisine or flavors or culture really as a kind of direct influence, but it was definitely there in other ways. So like, you know, I think about the philosophy that we were kind of brought up with. Like, we were taught not to be wasteful. We were taught to be very considerate of where things come from, and again, the human side and the environmental side of that, without them being either of those kind of terminologies layered on top of it. I think it was just a very Sri Lankan approach to things. You know, that was instilled in us without it really being overtly layered as being Sri Lankan.
No, that makes a lot of sense in terms of being, you know, as a migrant or you're with multiple cultures in a new space, right?
So. Absolutely. And I think it was definitely a tactic of my parents kind of being in a new place and going, well, we want everybody to be safe and assimilate and be able to work in this new environment. It's not an uncommon story. But what was like really amazing then was all of the other things that we're surrounded by. You know, we're in Birmingham. It's a big city. I talk about the fact that a lot of the first influences on me, apart from British culture, was Chinese culture. And that was to do with neighbours. It's to do with my oldest friend who's half Chinese. It's to do with the things that we loved. You know, I used to go to our neighbour's house when we were coming back from school or something like that. Like, if my parents were busy or just wanted to get rid of us. Like, we were there having this incredible like set of aromas kind of wafting in. It was therefore what we then kind of requested our mum to cook whenever there was an opportunity. We didn't eat out lots as kids, but if there was ever a chance, it was to go to this Chinese, you know, there was two Chinese restaurants that we used to go to. And then as we grew older, I was, you know, doing sports and music. And as part of that, like, there was going out with friends and again, would go to a Chinese restaurant as part of that as a kind of ritual or reward, as it were. I had this kind of massive influence on me in terms of those flavors and the diversity of ingredients and textures and aromas. I feel very grateful for that as kind of a grounding, because I think partly that joined with then, you know, the as I say, that curiosity that was instilled in us. We had to try new things. It was important to be understanding of the fact that there would be differences and it might be new to you, but there's a beauty to observe in that. We were taught to cook, we were taught to observe things when we were traveling to new places, but it meant that I was less freaked out by stuff than a lot of my friends were, kind of as soon as I got to uni and noticing people who were way more reluctant around, you know, particularly if you've grown up with a British palate, things like textures. And it didn't occur to me. I was like, well, why wouldn't you try that? Or why is that weird? Or what is it to be weird? I think that...
What is weird, yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah. And I think even that as a point, I think was, you know, it was instilled very young, that that's a really disrespectful way of looking at the world. But to be kind of exposed to it and be curious about it has, it definitely like set up the path that we've kind of all gone down. And I think it's interesting because all of my siblings, you know, I work in food, but all of us love it. And we all use it in a similar way of both a social tool. And I think that was directly from our parents.
Do you remember the kind of MSG stuff that happened around Chinese restaurants when you were young?
Yeah, I do. I remember there being that typical casual racism that just spread through, and it was, you go to a Chinese restaurant, you get a headache. You have to drink loads of water because they pump it full of this stuff. I really remember it being so, like, normalized as a conversation, and even as a child being like, what are you talking about? Like, you know, this isn't that weird a thing, right? There is, like, huge swathes of culture, and this is, like, an important part of their food. Why are we kind of expecting it to be inferior? And I remember that being, as a child, very confused that that was an outlook. But I suppose as well, it was like that confusion around racism as a kid anyway, and being like, what is going on? But yes, it was prevalent, and it was like fairly universal as an outlook.
And just thinking about what you're saying about the different kind of roads you've traveled, like you did arts and you did sciences.
Yeah.
And did you also learn to cook professionally?
Yes. Yeah, it was the journey. Cooking was first. I did it because I loved it as a topic. And as I say, we grew up cooking. From a very young age, we were just helpers in the kitchen and we enjoyed it. We loved food. We loved being around these things. The only thing that we did kind of get is a Sri Lankan influence of so many cakes baked in my house. It's a Sri Lankan thing, very much my mum and her consideration. She was like, if there's ever we're going somewhere, or if it's somebody's birthday or something happened for somebody, she would bake them a cake. She was so considerate, which was so ironic because I'm a terrible baker. We were taught to be capable, right? We had to be able to look after ourselves, but also cooking being not just a functional thing, it was a joyous thing. I knew I was coming down to art college and I wanted to do something practical. I loved the act of cooking, and I just wanted to learn some of the practical sides of it. And I was curious about it. I always enjoyed it. Like, I would observe different things about different restaurants I would go to, or different cuisines, or how somebody cooks something. So I was like, it'd be great to know the practicalities of this stuff. When I applied to the College of Food and Tourism in Birmingham, and I just wanted to do the cooking course, and they were like, oh, you did really well in your A-level, surely you want to do this big degree of things. And I was like, no. And they kind of convinced me. They were like, we'll give you extra time in the kitchens if you enroll in this course. And it was called Culinary Arts and Management. Even in the kitchen side, it wasn't what I loved about food. It was great to know some of the practicalities, the timing, the organization. And actually a lot of that did come with me into then setting up bars and the way that we operate in the live venues. But it was still just so removed from how I wanted to interact with people. So went from cooking to fine art, another crisis of identity, and was like, I need to do something academic. Went and did biology, and then didn't love the kind of like heavy physics side of a lot of kind of studying, you know, sciences at that level, and then did philosophy. the final time.
I feel like all these things are so obvious in your work.
Absolutely. They all seem very linked to me as well. To me, they're the same subject. And particularly what I took from each of those things, it was about people. That's what was interesting to me. And, you know, even when I did my master's thesis was on social contract theory, which is not what I kind of expect. I started doing philosophy of arts and music and then ended up doing social contract. But I was like, it's about how we gather. And there's something that's, you know, that to me has always been fascinating. And I, you know, social contract theory was much more about what is the actual like mechanism of how we do that. But I was like, well, what's the joy of that? And that to me is what is exciting about the world of hospitality, is understanding those different influences to then go, well, how do we create something that can feel magical around that as well?
I mean, this research about MSG and the history of MSG and umami is actually a research of culture.
Absolutely.
And it's been really amazing to just actually talk to people, yeah, about their histories and their relationship to food,
yeah,
and then the relationship to culture and racism, and so it's suddenly totally almost not about flavour.
This reflects a point I made in episode one, that the question isn't about flavour, but what does flavour mean to you? And the answer to this is all the points that Ryan makes. Flavour, as a personal pursuit, is also about culture, about people, about connections. We can take a scientific approach to thinking about food, but it's never going to capture its entire meaning. It's so much more than pure science.
The science is about the codifying of it, but it's almost like the actual expression of it is way more important. I obviously believe in the pursuit of science and the understanding of things, but it's where you get that intersection with the human side, the social side, the cultural element. That's where it becomes something really special.
If you fundamentally understand umami and its position as a fifth taste, then MSG makes a lot of sense. But the West can feel so resistant to otherness until it has, quote unquote, certified it. Then suddenly, we can do great things with it.
You take something like MSG, and it was amazing when, you know, we did start to understand those things. It's great, and it's allowed us to kind of push that and develop it. And unfortunately, it was like a good, just because it's been kind of like demonstrated in science, it's got, you know, enough kudos to be able to be accepted by the West.
What is the future of MSG? Or what is the future of umami? How can we start creating new traditions and bringing people in and seeing it through a new sort of lens?
Yeah.
And one of the things I was thinking about, which is sort of where this topic has come to, is this idea that drinks and the kind of culture of drinks globally has changed and shifted, and the drinks world feels incredibly global, like it's getting influences from all sorts of places and growing almost as a community, the savory drinks and the science behind making drinks is being pushed. I feel like the cocktail world is seen as and approached as akin to the kitchen.
I just see them as the same thing. You're absolutely right. It's incredible to see the kind of growth. And I think the growth is also just in both the spaces and the type of occasions in which kind of venues and kind of creators are catering to. But it's just like the audience that's coming into that. And I think that's come as a result of people realizing bars, and that's where I will separate the drink side from the food, is about social space. It's not about what we're consuming. And so it doesn't matter if it's alcoholic or not. There's a wider range of points at which you're in a bar. Like, you could be in there for a daytime meeting as well as a date or a celebration or commiseration, all of those things. And so I think the kind of span of times and occasions in which people are coming to the bar has changed. And that's really exciting. And that's opened up so much of the way that people are thinking and exploring the products that are working in that space. And I think the kind of umami idea in general has, like, across food and drink has kind of become really fascinating as a space, because and it's often people discovering techniques from other knowledge sets from around the world, and, you know, particularly as things have stopped being so Western-centric on stuff, you know, even the idea of fermentation, like, and, you know, how much that unlocks, well, a range of different kind of aspects to ingredients. What else can it start to open out? So as people have started to even look at the idea of fermentation and understanding what it can kind of open up from ingredients, but also, you know, particularly add in some of these kind of like richer, deeper, more delicious umami kind of senses. But it means that they're folding in whole new sets of substrates that maybe wouldn't have been part of those in a traditional sense. So it's a really exciting time for meeting some of these, you know, and some of them are getting loosely called a kind of like miso or a garum or whatever it might be. And I think back to some of the stuff that we do. It's like going, well, we'll take some butternut squash that's grown down the road from us, and all of a sudden it's tasting like tropical fruits. Or you're using, you know, very seemingly mundane ingredients, something that wouldn't have traditionally made it into a miso in Japan or a, you know, chicha in kind of Peru. You've ended up with this wonderful kind of medley of flavors kind of entwined with this kind of umami note and this kind of savory richness. And I think it's opened up a whole breadth of kind of flavor palette, but also thinking for people. And as these things have started to become kind of more common, and not just in the drink sphere, in food, in, you know, things that people are picking up from the supermarket, that juxtaposition of flavors is becoming much more understandable to people. It's the equivalent of everybody realizing that actually when you made a caramel, you would add salt to it to balance it. And then they're like, oh my God, salted caramel. And so they're kind of going, well, actually, savory flavors can coexist with these other things. You know, I referenced Peru and Japan there. You go to these countries and you get their like local drinks, and they balance a kind of savory and sweet kind of mixture. The idea of balance isn't just sweet. It's a really exciting time for unlocking what does the sense of flavor and balance look like.
Can you think of how you would use MSG in a drink?
We've used it in both a naturally formed way, where we've kind of added either in an ingredient that is very high in kind of glutamates and kind of unlocking it, usually through fermentation, or we've added it as MSG. And, you know, I think the thing you've got to kind of temper is too much that your body indicates as deliciousness. You can start to feel strange when you're not then biting into something, or it's not then linked with something that you know is of that savouriness, if that
like
makes sense.
Like a texture?
Yes.
Like you need to crunch up, not crunch.
Yeah.
Yeah, okay. Yeah,
or
yeah,
you need to be like, oh, okay, I can taste mushrooms, and therefore that big whack of like savoury is therefore, it feels right in my head. It's the same way that sometimes if you have something that's flavoured with strawberry, but there's no sugar to connect to, your body's like, this doesn't taste right. Something like a clover club, which is like light and fluffy and pink, and there's like a joyous zestiness to it. But then all of a sudden, when you introduce something like some MSG, it's that bit of funk to it that means that the raspberry tastes more of picking a raspberry rather than it just being like light and zesty. It's not that this therefore is your miracle solve to everything. Like, you don't necessarily want a pinch of salt or MSG or, you know, other kind of richer characteristics in every drink, but it almost can work in every application. It just shifts the emotion of the drink in quite a different way.
That is fascinating. That sort of blows my mind, actually. Like, I've not thought about the idea, but I guess conjuring flavor is about creating the layers. And, you know, we don't think about that in drinks, because we think about it, drinks, as like this liquid that you just put into a glass.
Yeah.
As opposed to a series of ingredients.
You can create new things, you can interject things, you can change the textures, the glassware, any of that stuff. And I think that then, as like a canvas to be able to kind of interact with people, is a very fun thing to kind of play with.
It feels like you're adding another layer of what culture means in drinks. Because if we think about drink, like, people commiserate, they celebrate,
yeah,
and they go to drinks, and it doesn't have to be alcoholic. All cultures have,
yeah,
a variety of drinks that represent them or situations.
Yeah.
And so now it kind of feels like, and this is probably not new, but for the moment it feels newish. So there's like an added element of, I don't know, cultural engagement.
100%. But it's almost in the same way that we're rediscovering a lot of things within food. It's a big sense of rediscovery with drink, because we've just discounted it and everything. Me a bit on soapbox. So food has taken the glory in this sense, because everybody's like, oh, but you need to eat. And that's where, you know, it's got this primary necessity. Well, actually, we had a much more pressing need to have potable water. And actually, a lot of our customs of what we have created, drinks were much earlier as a development and much more of a social guide than the food was just a function. And so a lot of these things, if you look back historically on, you know, the way in which we gathered, those rituals, those sense of identity, where you connected to your land, what you preserved, what you gifted to people, what you warred over, was actually your drinks. And so it's got this huge sense of cultural identity. It's just that we've often severed it because alcohol is a complicated role in society, which is a justified thing. It can be very damaging. I'm not discounting that fact. But as soon as we start to think as drinks, as it's just a social expression of our food, it's not alcohol it's not just about the booze. It's about the fact that whatever we did to kind of create these moments of togetherness, you then start to realize that, you know, every culture's got a lot to kind of reconnect with in terms of it. And it's often there. It's just often we kind of see it in quite a mundane way. Oh, people just go to the pub and drink beer. Mm. But
or
there's
have a cup of tea. Yeah.
Absolutely.
Yeah.
Yes, of course I want to go to, you know, somebody's local restaurant, but I also want to know what happens when you go to their house and they serve you something to sit and chat with. And that's, yeah, it might be snacks, but it's often a tea or it's a, you know, a soda or something that's kind of grown out of course, the land, but the culture and the people.
And then the final question is, what would be your favourite drink that has a savoury umami-ness to it?
There is a big fave for me has been kind of going out to Japan and trying, like, yes, there's stuff like the amazake, but there's even some of the, like, fermented teas or roasted teas that develop this kind of, like, much deeper umami note to them. And I think some of those are, you know, it's fascinating because you're expressing it from this plant and that's all you're kind of bringing out. And I still find tea one of the most insane products in the world. So I've loved those, but I still have this kind of soft spot for, you know, it's often in hot countries where you're kind of replenishing electrolytes that you'd have things like, you know, there's a soda in Mexico called Squirt, which was the original thing for a Paloma, Pocari Sweat in kind of Japan, but even like a Michelada, where you're getting that balance of zestiness, refreshing, and this savory component to it. You know, just having that kind of like savory, zesty kind of like interplay, that to me is still like, they're like magical drinks because you're like, this is exactly what I need in this heat. And like, you know, I've been traipsing around. I need something to kind of really feel rejuvenating. But it is that kind of sense of balance because they teeter the line perfectly between that savoury, the zesty, and that kind of refreshing element.
I hadn't actually thought about that because that the savoury, zesty combo. My favourite drink ever is Three Sours. So it's a calamansi lime, a normal lemon, and then sour plum, like dried sour plum.
Oh.
And then a lot of salt.
That sounds great.
So
why have I never had that?
And I guess the fermented plum probably has an umami to it as well then. Yeah, interesting.
It was so interesting to hear this, particularly the specific example of the Paloma, which became a very it drink in London over the last decade. It's now usually made here with Ting, or another grapefruit soda that doesn't have the salty flavour that Pocari Sweat or Squirt has, so that layer of complex savouriness sitting against the sweetness of the fruit has been removed. It's a shame! That layer of umami in drinks can add such texture. Flavour can be enhanced and played with. There's so much potential for fun and playfulness in developing drinks. There is an openness for drinkers towards creativity and new inventions, and I think it's really exciting to see what bartenders are doing with MSG. I invited Xian Wong to join us at the bar at Mr. Lion's studio so that she could show us how MSG works and the flavours of the drinks she creates. Like others I've spoken to in this series, such as Angela Hoy and Chin Taylor, Xian grew up in the family business of restaurants, in her case, run by her granddad in Newcastle.
So my granddad had the genius idea. He actually passed away this year, and after he passed away, I had to host the wake, writing for that and like asking questions. And I'm like, God, I can't believe I didn't know all this stuff, which is, I guess, is actually quite normal for Asian families because you just don't talk about anything. Like storytelling is a very different scenario. He wasn't a big talker. He was a big doer, unless he had a drink. I think he founded the Chinese Society up north, like the Chinese Committee, and he got a lot of, like, there were so many people, there was like 100 people that showed up, and he was 97, so he touched a lot of lives, so he helped a lot of families come across, sort out paperwork, get settled. I think he opened one of the first, like, Asian supermarkets, and then from that, he opened one of the first dim sum restaurants, and he had dim sum trained chefs from Hong Kong who, like, executed dishes there. So people used to come from all over the UK to eat there. So I didn't realize how lucky, because that's actually, like, crazy crazy lucky. So, I mean, I'm a bit fussy when it comes to flavor and food, but it's not, I just got so spoiled, you know? So I'm like always seeking the next best tasty thing because I've just, that's the standard.
That's how you grew up.
That's how you grew up. That's so your heritage, your legacy. That with like, it doesn't matter what it is it a soft drink? Is it wine? is it a smoothie? I'm like, is it tasty though? But what is it? Is it tasty?
I mean, I feel like there's a growing trend on umami and savory drinks. And mm-hmm. for me, that seems like something that's come out of Asia in particular. When I was in Singapore, just before the pandemic, I went to Native and all the drinks were so delicious and they were really savory. And I think that makes sense in Southeast Asia, which is what I know. Mm-hmm. Palate is so much more savory.
Yeah.
But that now is becoming much more of a thing throughout the world.
Yeah, for sure. It's interesting with each culture in Southeast Asia in particular. So, you know, growing up in a Cantonese household and having sweet and sour is like a big thing, but sweet, sour and savory, you know, hot and sour, but it's hot, sour, savory. Like the savory is just always there. And then different countries are different trends. Like in Japan, everything is very dry. All the cocktails are not sweet. Desserts are really sweet, but the food and the drinks are super, super like either savory or just like clean, really, really clean. And then they rely on, you know, the minerality in the soda water. So like they pick up on things that are a lot more subtle. And then in the Savory Project in Hong Kong is a cocktail bar. All their like main cocktails are all savory. I think I probably had the best martini I've ever had there. And I've drank a lot of martinis. It was excellent. It was really, really good. I think they fat washed. They did an olive oil fat wash. I don't know what it was. It was excellent. I'm actually still thinking about it. It lives rent-free in my mind.
Amazing.
Yeah, I'm actually going to go back and have one, I think.
One of those things that's been interesting to see is that a lot of that innovation has been around flavor and understanding flavor and being creative with flavor, like not using citrus, like understanding acid in a different way or understanding those flavor profiles.
Yeah, and texture.
And texture and what are we, you know, how do we bring that in? And I think that's probably why I felt or I think that things like savory drinks and like bringing in MSG into drinks makes a lot of sense.
It makes a lot of sense.
Because there's so much playfulness and so much innovation that happens in the cocktail world.
Yeah.
That I don't think the general public necessarily realize
about. Yeah. The curiosity of flavor, people always associate with chefs and with food, but the curiosity of flavor and texture happens a lot with drinks. So in terms of adding savory elements and saline and seasoning, anything that has natural glutamate in it, so like cheese powder, mushrooms and chocolate. I think a really easy gateway for savory umami cocktails is pairing it with something that's quite familiar. So like, I feel like mushroom chocolate's also not a surprise, not even in the drinks world, but just kind of like in the wellness world has become a thing. That's a really easy gateway. I mean, like flavors like that just work really well.
Cian's cocktail containing tomatoes, dried seafood and MSG solution, as she mentions here, is a thing of beauty. She originally developed it for an event and agreed to recreate it for us.
The XO Tomatotini, and it was to pair up with the starter dish, charred XO braised chicken hearts. I'm just rimming the glass, so this part of the garnish is a little bit of dehydrated tomato powder, so that you'll get that kind of like umami taste instantly when you sip through it. This is a 40. This is a 30. Okay, let's do. There's a clarified Clamato cordial.
15, 10, 40.
Another spirit that is naturally really savory is mezcal. And then we are gonna be putting in the manzanilla, which is 30. I feel like sherry is really understated and also underused and essential for savory cocktails. And a little bit of that delicious Saint-Germain elderflower liqueur, 5 mils. With the tomato aspect, I wanted that kind of like freshly picked vine tomato flavor. So we just add a dash of Saint-Germain to kind of like give it that, you can almost like see the fur on the vines, the tomato, and just like really helps it pop. And how much cordial did I put in there? Let's have a look. 25. Cool. There's a clarified Clamato cordial, which is really tasty. So obviously tomato also contains natural glutamate, and clams, yet again, XO clams just enhances that a little bit. And then to make it kind of the texture silky and the flavor consistent, it was just put through a centrifuge and then added sugar and acid to turn it into a cordial. So if you can imagine what Clamato juice looks like, and now as you can see, it's kind of like this vibrant, like orange liquid. It's nice and clear. I think cordials are a really good way forward because you're using the sweet, which people are already associate with drinks, and then you're using the acid, which obviously balances out the sweet, and then you put the savoury aspect in there, and it's just, it's like, you know what a really good example of that balance is that I love, and I think most people would probably have tried at some point, pad thai sauce. Like, have you ever made pad thai sauce?
I have not, but I know
you know the ingredients. Yeah. So you can buy it like, you know, as a, in a all made up in a jar. But then when you separate the ingredients, it's like fish sauce, punchy. You've got the cane sugar element to that. You've got tamarind, and it's basically all those things, but it's super, super savory. Once you get the balance right, when you put the right amount of sugar, the right amount of like fish sauce in, and lime, it's like, oh my God, that is so satisfying. It just hits every part of your tongue. There's a little bit of XO oil in there. So XO oil is predominantly made from aromatized dried seafood. So scallops is a big ingredient, but then also you can do like prawns and shrimps. It's just absolutely delicious. If you ever go to Scully's in St. James's Park and ask him for his XO jam, that it's like, he will give you a little bit and you can take it away and it will enhance every single dish. Like my instant noodles or toasties or bread and butter, like anything. It's just brilliant. So I've got like not a homemade Scully's version, but just like just supermarket version, which is also great. Dash of MSG solution. So that is just a 1 to 10 MSG salt with water and then just like a dash of that just to make it pop. Extra seasoning, a little bit of sugar, and manzanilla sherry.
The resulting drink was sweet, savory, and intense. I was so intrigued by the choice of the elderflower Saint-Germain alongside the deeply savoury XO oil, enhanced by a clever MSG solution.
So this is kind of like, take the idea of a savoury Bloody Mary, but then you take an idea of a martini, but a martini that doesn't have any gin or vermouth, and instead you substitute it with mezcal. And you take the spirit element and you use like a mezcal, and you take the fortified wine element and you replace it with sherry, but then you have that extra injection of savory MSG, tomato, clams. I'm just going to finish with a couple of drops of delicious XO sauce. So you get that on the nose. If you're a pescatarian, then great. If you have any allergies to seafood, stay away from this drink. Right, shall we?
Yeah.
Okay, great.
Cheers.
Cheers.
And here we are at the end of our 5-episode journey. MSG has played a role in so many people's lives. It has travelled the world and has been an anchor for home. It is an ingredient that has been racialized and weaponized unlike anything else I can think of. And yet it creates umami, a taste we all crave. Why are we still having this conversation? Why are we still talking about MSG? Several people we interviewed, Mimi, Chin, Tim, talked about how attitudes have changed towards MSG more recently, and there is more understanding and acceptance. But the rejection of it as an ingredient has recently grown another head, as we read daily headlines claiming that all UPFs are bad for us. It is important to be aware of the racist origins of the MSG backlash, so we can look clearly and critically at new so-called food scandals as they happen. We did not want to create a debate, but it is impossible and disingenuous to talk about MSG without talking about racism and the politics of identity, belonging, and home. This means we've had to spend some time explaining the science of why it isn't bad for you.
But more than anything, we really wanted to centre the people who use MSG and how they are all so key to the British culinary landscape. We wanted to tell their stories, their communities, and give context to the foods that use MSG and the foods that are umami bombs. Lekker is always a podcast about people, and it is a podcast about creativity. We hope that that has been your takeaway. Incredible people making incredible food and drink and pushing the boundaries of what is possible and creating a simply delicious landscape to be in. Thank you for listening to Be Delicious. This is officially the final episode in this Lekker mini-series, but very soon you can also hear me talking to Lucy about my book, Chinese and Any Other Asian, on the podcast. It's so relevant to so many of the conversations I've had for this series, and it's out now. Thanks also to Kang for all his research backup, support, and huge encouragement. If you're enjoying the series, please leave a rating and review for Lekker on Apple Podcasts. It really helps new listeners find the podcast. To Be Delicious was presented by me, Dr. Anna Sulan Mussing, and produced for Lekker by me and Lucy Dearlove. Our original theme music was composed by Midori Yeager. Our podcast artwork was by Natasha Pang Lee. This project was made possible by the support of the European Committee for Umami and Ajinomoto. If you've enjoyed this series, you'll also enjoy my first book, Chinese and Any Other Asian, Exploring East and Southeast Asian Identity in Britain, out now, which you can order on the link in the show notes for this episode.